Okay. Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Greg.
So I got my $2. Who's got the basket? So my name is Greg. I am an alcoholic. It's really neat to come and speak when the podium's shorter than I am. You did a great job in choosing this thing. My date of sobriety is January 15th, 1999. My home group is the Springville Gut Level Group, meets Thursday night, Lighthouse Chapel in Springville, California. My current service position is the District 47 Treasurer. I want to thank Bill for asking me. He calls me periodically and asks me to come and share with you. It's been a couple of years. My life changed 5 months ago, and so tonight's a healing event for me. And so my story changed. And so, you know, it's an opportunity for me to kind of hit the refresh button. 5 months ago, Christmas Day, my wife of 40 years became ill, and 8 days later she left her body and moved on to a purely spiritual plane. She still walks with me, and she's with me now. So I want to talk tonight about, on page 164, next to the last paragraph, last line, trudge the road of happy destiny. You know what, I've heard that many, many times, didn't really understand what it meant. Dug out the dictionary. My sponsor was one of those guys that says, you think you know what the meaning is, but you don't until you look it up. And so I looked up these terms. Trudge, walk laboriously to labor. Road, a course, a path, a route. The one that caught me off guard was happy. I thought it was some kind of joyousness, but the way it's used in this particular sense, it's fortunate or lucky. And then destiny, predetermined, inevitable course of events. So, you know, what I've come to learn is that I was born into this world on June 5th, 1955, to a family by destiny. And so I come into this family where the parent, the father, was in this relationship, escaping the controlling attitude of his mother. And the wife, my mother, was in this relationship because she was escaping a broken home situation. And these two melded together at a very early age in life, and their first offspring was me. The first child born on in that family unit, meaning in the extended family, the first grandson, and they spoiled the hell out of me, you know, and I became a person with great attitude. So, you know, early in life, if I didn't get my way, I would go somewhere and pout and punish you while I sat in the corner and said, hey, you know, I'm over here. You see me? I'm pouting, and you should respect my lack of concern for you. So that became my adolescence, and that kind of blossomed along the way, you know. And I in time, I had three younger sisters. I had an uncle who was about 11 years older than me, and I would spend my summers with he and my maternal grandfather. That was, you know, broken home. He'd moved away. He was in Northern California running a lumber mill, and I would go and spend 6 weeks each summer with him and my uncle. And in time, my aunt, who I call frequently and make amends to her, because I learned what a dickhead I was, you know, all those summers I spent with her, and I owe an apology. Age 7, with my uncle, a bottle of wine's being passed around, I'm included. I have a a drink or two or ten out of that bottle, and I get a warm feeling, and I feel comfortable, and I feel connected. That little boy that would hide in the corner or sit in the corner and pout never felt connected. When I imbibed a little bit, I felt different. Teenage years, alcohol became a form of therapy. You know, the insanity of going through adolescence and then puberty and then whatever it is you experience as a teenager, it's just insane, you know. And alcohol would give me a slight reprieve from that. And so that's what I did. Weekends, you know. I'd been to a few with my buddies, and that's the way it comes along. Now, here is the beginning of the destiny part of the thing, the fortune. When I'm in junior high, I meet this gal, we're in the band together, and we become friends. And she's the kind of friend that was a bit of a tomboyish character, you know, liked to poke me, punch on me, those kinds of things. And she's in the seventh grade, I'm in the eighth grade, we're both playing instruments in the band. And then I move on to high school, and I don't see her again until my sophomore year. And in my sophomore year, here she appears again, you know, and we're still horsing around with each other. And we're there is no designs of romance or attraction or any of that kind of thing. It's just, you know, kind of buddies. The following year, which is my junior year, we're getting ready to go on a long band trip. And she asked me where I was going to sit, and I said, I don't know. And she says, there's a seat right here. And I sat with her, and 48 or 60 hours later, there's electricity, and that becomes destiny. And that lady becomes the only woman I ever knew. My previous story was all about talking about my Al-Anon, and many times she'd be sitting in the room, you know, keeping me honest. And today, off to the side here, is my family support group, which is all part of who she is, and she's there with them at this moment. She hung with me. As turns out, taught me. Loved me when I didn't know how to love myself. Kicked me when I needed to be kicked. She was on a higher spiritual plane than I recognized at the time. I thought that I was gaining some measure of spirituality that was on a higher level than what she possessed, and as it turns out, I was wrong. Amongst other things, I was wrong with this lady. So we began our courtship, and a few years later, there was marriage, and children came, and we, you know, I went to the business of earning an income, and she went to the business of developing a family. And she had the values in that camp, and I had the values in my camp, and somewhere between us there was wholeness. Alcohol was not a daily routine at that time. Alcohol was definitely a periodic routine, and the blackout thing would appear. In fact, when I got a DUI in about 1991, and you guys remember our old friend Jim Looper, and he used to have a service opportunity of coming around to those first offender programs and talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of his pitches was about blackouts, you know. And to me, a blackout was the norm of drinking. I didn't realize it was abnormal. And he explained to this group of beginners, in terms of getting in trouble with the law, perhaps, first offender for me, I got to tell you about that. That scared the hell out of me. You know, this thing about getting in trouble with the law and then going to court and then being sentenced, you know, was kind of like my defiance had come face to face with another level of defiance. In other words, it didn't really matter whether or not I was going to sit in the corner and pout, cop an attitude, or try to punish you with my behavior. The court of law said, "This is just the way it is. You're going to have to go. You're going to have to go to road camp." You know, and it was scary for me to go out there to that facility at Sequoia Field and spend what turned out to be one weekend, but the sentence was 3 weekends, and they commuted 2 of them because I had spent the night in the drunk tank, and then someone else made sure that the one at the back end disappeared. And so I get there and I'm scared to death. You know, I figured I was either going to get beat up or I was going to get raped. Neither one of them happened. And as it turns out, all the guys in this little dorm kind of had the same concerns. You know, we're all first offenders. And I had heard those stories about jail, and didn't work out that way. My wife wasn't happy about me calling her the day that I was arrested and saying, "Hey, I got a DUI and I'm in jail and you need to go pick up my car and come and get me in the morning." And she wasn't very happy. In fact, that was the beginning of some great unhappiness in our home. There was probably just cause. Anyway, I did my program. I did my AA meetings. Well, do you remember you were sitting at the back of the courtroom waiting for me? Up front here is my high school friend, and he at the time was signing us up for the first offender program, and so he's waiting for me, and he says, "I've been saving you a chair," you know, so I get hooked up with that thing. And I do, and they tell me I have to go do these AAA meetings, you know, and I was not one of you. I was a visitor when I came to an AA meeting. I was in defiance of admitting that I had a problem with alcohol. I was unlucky. And I went to 15 classes? I think it's something like that. I had to do 15 classes, and I that's when I met Looper, and I learned a little bit about the disease of alcoholism, but that was you, that wasn't me. But I made a commitment to my family that I would not drink for 6 months to, I guess, prove to them that in my concept of what an alcoholic is, I wasn't one of them, meaning an alcoholic. You see, my concept of an alcoholic was based upon being a young man, being out in the fields with my grandfather, going by some people in Poplar, California, hanging around a burn barrel at 4 o'clock in the morning, passing a brown paper bag with a green bottle in it. And I would ask my grandfather, "What is that?" And he says, "Those are winos." "Well, what are they?" "Well, they're alcoholics." "Well, I don't understand." He says, "Well, they can't stay away from alcohol." So my whole concept of an alcoholic was brown paper bag, green bottle, hanging around a burn barrel, passing it around with each other, and that's all you can do. Never mind the fact that I would leave Orange Cove, California on afternoon about 3:30 and stop the minute mark and get a 24-ouncer in a brown paper bag and suck on that until I got to Seville and get another 24-ouncer, which would get me over to Spruce, and I couldn't drive on Spruce because they patrol that street, you know. And so I wouldn't drink. And then I would drive into the Eagles Lodge in Porterville at 4 o'clock. I don't wear a watch, but I knew what time it was. It's 4 o'clock. The bar opens at 4. I'll be there at 4. I was there at 4, maybe 3:55. And the door would open, and I'd go and sit down and start drinking. You see, I wasn't an alcoholic. I wanted to go be with my buddies and have a cocktail. And what I learned along the way was that I would go in with the intention of having two, and then going home to my loving wife and my two boys. But there was never two. I mean, the minute one hit my lips, I was there until they closed, and somebody drove me home so that I wasn't driving drunk, because they're patrolling the streets of Porterville. You know, they might pull me over, and I might have to be in a second offender program. And I didn't want to do that. The insanity began to really, really work in my life. You know, this being in trouble with the law, which I'd never been, the defiance, the attitude that I'm not like you, my wife on me about, you know, you've got a problem, you got to do something about this. It just became intense. And I'm trudging this road. I mean, really laboriously trying to get through each day. It's a trudge. But there is no happiness. What I'm learning today is that it was part of the destiny. I had to reach a point where I made a decision. I have a loving friend, saw this unfolding, kept coming to me with these interventions, got to where I didn't want to see him. If I saw him come through the door, I turned my head and go a different direction. I knew he was going to talk to me about my problem. And something happened. You know, I had this moment of clarity that I could see myself. It was like a third eye. I was in the throes of my addictive behavior. I saw myself in a situation that was less than becoming. Recognized that I was in a physical situation that could end in a heart attack. And I didn't stop, but I remembered that. And when that fourth intervention came, I said, yeah, I think maybe I do have a problem. Maybe. But it's interesting how the Spirit uses just that little crack in my willingness to begin to do His work. And He began to align things in my psyche and in my life and in the world so that I could find this path, okay, this road to happy destiny. And so this path began to unfold, and I said, yeah, but I don't know what to do about it. And my friend says, we do. Pack your bags, you're gone tomorrow. And off I went to a treatment center. Now, my self-centeredness is such when I get to this treatment center, I'm checking out all their credentials. You know, I'm looking for the PhD in this joint, and there isn't one. I can't even find a psychologist in this place, you know. There's lots of people that understand chemical dependency and alcoholism, but they don't understand somebody that's wired like me. At least I thought. Turns out they knew very well. So I begin this path of dealing with my attitude and my intellect and all of the cursory stuff that I needed to get out of the way so that I could begin to get honest with me. And I had no idea of what that meant. But what happened for me was there was a anger management class one day that thoroughly pissed me off. And in that being pissed off, the insanity just percolated out of me. And nobody in that group got any work done that day because I was involved in all of their business. I was out picturing my discontent to them. And when my counselor showed up, I asked him, I said, why didn't they send me away to some padded room? And he says, well, why would they do that? And I said, because I'm insane. Oh, you feel insane? Yeah. Did you hurt anybody? Nope. Did you hurt yourself? Nope. Well, there's no need to send you to a padded room, but I have some questions for you, he says. Do you have a higher power? Yeah, I think I do. You know, I'm a farm guy. There's some kind of miracle going on out here. You plant a seed and it grows, you know. You do anything I ask? Yep, right now at this very moment, I am so raw, I'll do anything you ask. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to your bunk. I'm in a room with about 6 or 8 guys. Is that about, Mark, is that about how many were in there? Yeah, 6 or 8 guys. I'm on a lower bunk. He says, I want you to go to your bunk. I want you to ask your higher power to relieve you of the insanity. He never said one word about alcoholism. Relieve you of the insanity. And I said, okay, I can do that. I'm really willing at this point to be rid of that ugly, nasty, filthy feeling that insanity had left me with. So I go to my bunk and I get on it and I turn my head to the wall because I don't want those other guys to see what I'm doing. And from inside my gut, I ask this power greater than me to relieve me of that insanity. And I began to weep. And I cried myself to sleep. You know, and I haven't cried since I was probably 7 or 8 years old, you know. My pride was too strong for that. I could not show you that I was that, in my concept, weak. What I learned later was, is the next day I was remarkably different. I'd moved from being a person who was trying to think his way through those 12 steps on the wall to a person who was experiencing those 12 steps on the wall. And I began to learn that this is a program of experience, not intellect. Being smart is not a good thing in this program. Being willing to experience is a great thing in this program. And that's what took place for me. A couple of days later, my wife shows up, and she is just sick of this whole thing with me. In her hand is a goodbye letter, and in the other hand is a restraining order. You're no longer welcome in Porterville. I've changed the locks. And she tells the staff, you got him, you keep him, I don't want him coming back to Tulare County. You do whatever you want with him. And they said, well, wait a minute. We see a different character here. Let's see if we can work on this. So she allows me to return in a couple of weeks when I get out of this treatment center. We begin a path when I return in unison. She is an Al-Anoner by now. We join a family support group. Within a year, I'm involved in service. Within a couple of years, I'm traveling. You know, our area is the northern interior, runs from the Kern County line to the Oregon border. I've got a service position that allows me to travel that. I'm sick enough; I can't go back to work. So my vocation at that point is Alcoholics Anonymous, and she's traveling with me, and she begins to learn about our disease. She studies our disease. She studies me. She becomes great support to me. She kicks me in the ass and tells me it's time to go see my sponsor, you know, when my head's getting a little off the mark. You know, I'm just blown away by the love and compassion of codependents, of people that love us so much that they'll do everything in their power to help us. And we don't even recognize it. You know, I didn't recognize what she was doing for me at the time. What I recognized was I was feeling a little better. I was doing a little bit better. I was scratching around and just incrementally getting a little bit better than I was the day before. This disease of alcoholism had left me very, very sick. And I did not. If you're new, I hope that you recover quickly. For me, it took years. It took a couple of years before I could actually function in my... And I'm a self-employed guy, that I could function in my work environment. A couple of years. The In fact, that crew, when I did return, didn't want anything to do with me. They left. You know, it's a whole new group of people now. This path of destiny has a component of choice. When I made a choice to get cleaned up, a different road opened to me, a different path. Some of the destiny that I believe is predestined, predetermined. Some of it changes based upon the choices that I make. But in the grand scheme of things, I really think that my Creator had already saw that I was going to go through these events. And I needed to go through a certain number of these painful events that I became willing to continue to open up new channels, new paths, new avenues of recovery, new attitudes of recovery. You know, this idea of honesty and open-mindedness and willingness for an egocentric person is very foreign. It's in the pain, in the anguish of recovery that I become willing, that I become honest with me. You know, when everything's going well, why would I change? I really embrace this, what we might call a stumbling block or a painful event or an episode in our lives that is monumental, like my spouse dying. Today, I view it as an opportunity. So I worked steps, I got into service, I experienced unity, and my family was restored. I'd like to tell you all of that happened instantly, but it didn't. It took time. And, you know, I have a young son who now works with me. He's 34. He was 15 when I got sober. We were living in the same house. He didn't speak to me for 7 years. We'd pass each other in the hall. He'd just turn his head and go to his room and lock the door. You know, it took time. Now he phones me every morning at 5 o'clock, and we discuss the business of the day. You know, it's and it isn't something I did, other than become willingness to embrace you, embrace this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's something that a power greater than me ordered, and that's part of that destiny. The departure of my wife opened up a new channel for me, a new path. She was on life support 6 days, and her appendages were leaving her, and her life was draining away. I found her in a coma on the 27th of December, and her spirit was not there. You know, this aura that I had always enjoyed from that time that we sat on the bus to this time, which would be 44 years later, her spirit was not at home. When we removed the life support, there was my two sons and their wives and my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law and I had not really spoken since I got sober. She was not accepting of my situation. It was a moral issue with her. And as my wife is taking her last breath, my little mother-in-law, she weighs maybe 90 pounds. She was there all alone, and I scooped her up, and I held her. She calls me today. I want to take you to dinner on your birthday. I mean, what a miracle. What a change.
being there for her turns out to be a changing event for her. Her husband had passed a couple of years ago. She has been kind of depressed, not always healthy, staying at home a lot. And one of the habits that my wife and I enjoyed is on Sunday evenings we would go to Rose's, the local Italian restaurant, about 5:15, and have a simple dinner, just the two of us, and go over to Save Mart and get the few groceries we'd need for the week and go home. It was a ritual that we embraced. And in her departure, I missed that ritual. So I began to invite my mother-in-law to dinner, take her on Sundays. It's inspiring her to live. She's 81 years old. She's excited about life now. Is this part of the destiny? It's definitely part of the trudge. I'm walking this path with her. I'm happy about it. I enjoy spending time with her. What I'm trying to relate is as one door closes, another opens. And I don't know what that door is going to be, but if I embrace it, if I'm willing, if I'm open to it, then I get the opportunity to experience the peace and the freedom and the love. I joined a grief group. And it was interesting going to this grief group. There were, half a dozen women there. No men, you know. And so I look around the room, and it was, it's kind of like the first time I went to an AA meeting. I looked for the differences rather than the similarities, you know. And so I'm listening to their stories and saying, well, I'm not like that person or this person. My situation's different, you know. And I didn't know whether I'd return. So I left the meeting. And the next week, I thought, well, I'll give it one more try. But in reflection, I recognized that I felt better after I left. And I became a regular while that meeting was in session. It's a 10-week session. You know, those women taught me how to grieve. They taught me how to walk this path. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to sustain my spiritual connection as I walk this path. Today, I am grateful for the spiritual strength that this program has brought me, the fellowship, the restoration of my family, and the very simple principles of honesty and open-mindedness and willingness that I've begun to embrace in my everyday life. You know, it leaves me with a yearning to learn and an ability to listen and listen for the similarities and not the differences. So I'm about out of time, but I want to sum up this trudge the road of happy destiny with my definition of this. We labor in our course of this life, fortunate to have found the path of freedom, which is derived from the predetermined, inevitable events. Freedom of choice alters the path, adjusts the destiny, but does not change destiny. There is no coincidence that we are all in this room together tonight. Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
Very much, Greg. That was beautiful. Okay. The Valley Group encourages sponsorship and service to our fellowship. We invite you to come early and stay after the meeting to get better acquainted with our fellowship. Our business meetings are held at 6 p.m. on the last Wednesday of each month. If you consider yourself a member of this group, we invite you to serve our group with your participation. I'd like to...